Okay, welcome back. It's the Vegan Rainbow Show with Bill Houston.
And Mike Hudak.
How you doing today, Mike?
Oh, just fine, Bill. Our guest today is Patrick Deal, longtime social and environmental activist, former and current Green Party candidate for the 2nd Congressional District of Utah, former officer of the Sierra Club's Glen Canyon Group, and one of several plaintiffs in a lawsuit challenging the legality of the Sierra Club's just-completed election for its board of directors. Deal has bachelor degrees from Harvard University and Oxford University, where he was a Marshall Scholar. He received the Ph.D. in comparative literature in 1975 from the University of California at Berkeley, where he taught English and comparative literature until 1982. Patrick Deal joins us today from his home in Escalante, Utah. Patrick?
Yeah, hi there, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
Great, great. Let's talk about your background a little bit. You have a Ph.D. in comparative literature and have authored a few books in your discipline. What led you to abandon an academic career more than two decades ago now?
Well, I didn't get tenure at UC Berkeley where I was teaching. And before, I think a couple or three years before my contract ran out, actually before the denial of tenure, I got involved in the anti-nuclear movement. There was an effort within the faculty at UC Berkeley and throughout the UC system to get the university to end its contractual role with, I guess, DOE by then, to oversee the nuclear weapons design laboratories at Livermore and at Los Alamos in New Mexico. So that was about 1979 I got involved. And by the time my contract ran out with the university, the anti-nuclear movement had become quite impressive. That this was the year of the freeze, 1982, at least that's how I think of it. And I got involved with a large regional group that organized nonviolent civil disobedience.
Right, but this was the Livermore Action Lab. This was the Livermore Action Group.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I eventually was on their staff. I went to Europe in the late winter, early spring of 1983 to organize against the placement of the crews in Pershing missiles there, which happened, unfortunately, later on that year. So that was what I did for about 3 years. And I decided I liked being an activist, felt more useful than being an academic. So I never went back to academia.
And the Livermore Action Group did a lot of protests right there in California.
Yeah. Well, we also functioned after our first year on a national and international level, actually. But initially, we were organizing protests at the Livermore Lab, which went from, I think, a few dozen the first time around to about 1,400 by June of 82. Yep. So those were, that action, I think, was, if not the largest civil disobedience action in the country's history, certainly one of the largest at that time.
And you were with them for, you said, 3 years?
3 years, basically, yeah.
Up until 1985?
August 85, yeah.
And what other types of protest were you involved with in subsequent years?
Well,
you were still in California at that time.
Yeah, I left California in 98. So besides, let me think, I was involved in some protests against the Reagan policies concerning Central America in the 80s, El Salvador particularly. I remember a couple of arrests about that. And then at the end of the 80s, I became a war tax resister, which is a kind of a, you know, one-person form of civil disobedience, or at least one person at a time. And for 10 years, I filed my income tax return annually with the IRS, but did not send them any money. And that was initially because of, well, the nuclear policies of the American government, but also its really revolting behavior in Central America during the 80s. And I think also the first intifada came along about the time that I stopped paying income tax. So there were various, you know, affronts to decency and morality being committed by the U.S. government. I mean, what else is new, I guess, but they were simply too gross for me to feel that I could in conscience send them any money.
In doing research for this interview, I discovered a newspaper story that the Salt Lake Tribune did on you just a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess I was the featured person in that.
Right.
Yeah, there's kind of a tradition just before tax day, April the 15th, the media get interested in tax resistance each year and start calling around. So they got hold of me. I'm the contact for the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee here in Utah. And that's how they found out about me. Gave me a call, and I told them what I had done in the past and about the war tax resistance movement.
Right.
So they did an article about what I would call left-wing tax resistance, which I'm part of, and actually probably even more about right-wing tax resistance, which is much more popular here in Utah, as you might expect, which is takes the form of claiming that there's no constitutional basis for income tax, which I certainly do not agree with. My complaint is with what happens to the money, not with the government taxing people within reason anyway.
In that article, you mentioned some of the difficulties of holding to your position, that the government initiates certain actions against people like yourself. And
right.
I'm just wondering, what is that really like? You at least alluded to receiving threatening letters and being called in for meetings and so on. Have you actually been visited by anyone? Have you been called in for a meeting, a summoned to be at a location to discuss these matters?
That happened a couple of times in the early years when I lived in the Bay Area, but not for over a decade now, actually.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, they're just sending me automatically generated bills each year.
Oh.
Yeah, there's a 10-year statute of limitations at this point. It used to be 7. If you file but do not pay, there is no statute of limitations, by the way, listeners should be aware, for tax evasion, which applies to cases where people do not file an accurate return and are trying to evade taxes. You know, I'm in the category of willful refusal to pay. I mean, this is getting kind of technical, but there is that distinction.
Right.
Anyway, so at this point, I think that they probably feel that you can't get blood out of a stone. I don't own any property. I don't have a car. I don't have a bank account. I actually haven't filed since moving to Utah.
So 6 years.
Made any income in my own name since then. So what are they going to get from pursuing me? And they do have proprietary formulas, you know, software for deciding whether to proceed against people or not. You can't get the details of, you know, how they decide whether to go after someone, but it's well known that, you know, various parameters used to at least do a first pass and, you know, screen whom to consider for further attention.
Don't you fear that that certain people, you know, above and beyond automated, you know, screening program software that they might have, that you might be targeted for your activism? I guess empirically, they haven't done that.
Well, generally speaking, there have been very few prosecutions over the years for people doing what I've been doing. They try to seize assets, money, cars, you know, but they haven't shown a lot of interest in, you know, simply prosecuting people for left-wing tax resistance.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most famous recent case involved Randy Keeler in Massachusetts when his and his partner's house was seized by the IRS and sold, and there was ongoing civil resistance concerning that particular piece of property for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't remember a prosecution for willful refusal to pay for 20 years now.
Wow.
I think the IRS probably finds that each time it tries to commit an act of aggression, let us say, against someone doing left-wing tax resistance, there's lots of publicity, and it doesn't particularly benefit the IRS, and they don't get much out of it.
Mm.
So I think that occasionally they'll experiment with that kind of behavior, but it doesn't seem that it's working out very well for them. By contrast, they definitely do prosecute right-wing tax resistors regularly and do massive asset seizures because they tend to have a lot more money than us types and sometimes send them off to prison. the claim that the Constitution does not justify the existence of the IRS is obviously a very direct challenge to the IRS. So I think they get a lot more serious about that. Mm-hmm. If we became a larger movement, that is, we, the left-wing tax resistors, I think the IRS would start coming down much more heavily. At this point, I think they would rather just ignore us on the whole. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You said that they seized property mm-hmm. of this person in Massachusetts. Was
yes.
the property at least partly in the name of the tax resistor, or only that of his partner?
You know, I don't know the exact legal details. It was on land-trusted land. Therefore, the land that the house was sitting on could not be sold, that much I know. Mm. I don't know whether it was in Randy's name as well as his wife's. But I think probably it was. And for a long time, they probably relied on the fact that it was land-trusted to deter the IRS. And indeed, it was a very messy situation because the land was not alienable along with the house. And I think that was partly why the civil disobedience campaign was able to sustain itself for so long. I think eventually the house found its way back to the land trust. The family, which I believe the husband in it was a cop, you know, that figures, finally gave up because they were in such an uncomfortable position, sitting in the middle of a land trust run by peace activists in a house which, of course, their neighbors did not feel they should be occupying. It didn't work out very well for them, or as I think for the IRS either. Randy Keeler, by the way, was one of the two chief staff persons for the Freeze back in the early 80s, along with Randall Forsberg.
Oh.
So he's a rather notable character. Mm-hmm. I also heard Daniel Ellsberg talk once about how he went to a presentation by Randy back around 1970. I think Randy had been in jail for a couple of years for refusing to be drafted. And that was quite critical in Dan's deciding that he should go ahead and leak the Pentagon Papers. He felt that if somebody could go to jail for a couple of years over their refusal to be involved in the Vietnam War, he could do something himself. So that's just a little background mm-hmm. on Randy.
Very interesting. Now, you were involved in some other protests in the 1990s. Nuclear
right.
in origin, but not actually dealing with the production of nuclear weapons. And one I'm thinking
right.
about, which I've seen on a website that mentions you, regards a nuclear waste dump.
Yeah.
Ward Valley?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Friends of ours up in the Bay Area started getting involved in a campaign to stop a nuclear waste dump from being built just outside Needles, California, in the first high desert valley as you go west from Needles toward L.A. And my partner, Tori Woodard, and I got more and more involved in that as time went on. I actually contributed some of my resisted war taxes, as war tax resistors call them, early on to the campaign and helped sustain the occupation camp, the peace camp that was set up on the proposed site for the dump. I was also down there for about half of, I guess it was 95, 96, half of each month. Anyway, the campaign really took off in 95. We started having big gatherings down there. The Lower Colorado River tribes, there are five of them, I think, all together, got very involved in the campaign, eventually became quite central to it. And we actually succeeded in preventing the dump from being constructed there. When Gray Davis was voted in, he pretty much put the kibosh to the dump. One good thing that Mr. Davis did. So that went on, I suppose, a really active phase for about 3 years. I was down there a lot, and so was my partner.
Mm-hmm.
She was actually the staff person in the office in Needles for a while and did a lot of fundraising for it.
Mm-hmm.
So that all of that happened just before we moved here to Utah.
Yes. And so then you did move to Utah in 1998.
Right.
And have been involved in several types of activism in Utah. I believe you still continued your opposition to nuclear waste dumps, and you've been involved in what we might call anti-grazing activism,
yep.
and then some issues with the Sierra Club.
Right, and I was arrested a couple of times last March concerning the invasion of Iraq, including a sit-in in the office of my sometime opponent for in the second district, Jim Matheson, a Blue Dog Democrat. So, you know, the anti-war activism continued to some extent. I also am a nonviolence trainer, so I did some trainings up there for some of the people who got arrested with me, actually.
How do you characterize a Blue Dog Democrat?
Well, actually, that's their characterization of themselves.
Oh.
They have a website, which you can go look at, and they see themselves as a moderate bridge between the so-called Democratic and Republican extremes. Mm. Of course, a lot of us think that there isn't much difference between the Democratic and Republican parties, at least on average. Anyway, so here in Utah, Matheson is the Blue Dog Democrat. He's the only Democrat in the congressional delegation, actually. And I will admit that this is a very conservative state. I think probably it votes the most heavily Republican of any state in the country. So he's got kind of a tough row to hoe. Mm-hmm. But I also feel that really has no business calling himself a Democrat, even by the standards of the Democratic Party, which are quite low. And he deserves to be opposed for his loyal support of the Bush agenda, his support of the Iraq War, and his support of the proposed constitutional amendment forbidding gay marriage, and there's a long list of things that where I really disagree with him, and the Green Party, of course, does.
So you ran against Jim Matheson in 2002.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, what did you raise as the main issues in that campaign?
Well, at that point, the globalization issue was probably the main reason I got involved. I was very angry at his vote on, trying to think, what was it that time? One of the globalization measures. That was a little late for NAFTA. Sorry, I should remember. But there was a measure that passed by one vote in the House, which maybe one of you guys there remembers.
What year was it?
2002?
I think the vote was in 2001.
Oh.
Yeah. Not too long before the 2002 election. Which treaty ratification?
Well, fast track ratification. Is that the vote you're thinking?
Fast track, that's it. Yeah. Giving the, basically it gave the executive the power to put up a trade bill, mm-hmm. and it has to be voted up or down without amendment, which obviously greatly increases the power of the executive to force through trade bills which are not in the interests of people in general or people of the United States in particular. So, yeah, that was a specific bill that I was upset about. So that was a big issue then.
So how did that play in Utah?
Hard to say. The Utah media, like media generally, try to ignore Green Party candidates as much as they can. So it's very hard to know how your stands are playing with the electorate. I got some votes. Actually, Matheson almost lost to a very right-wing Republican challenger. If the party had put up someone a little more moderate, I think he would have been out. Huh. It was definitely a close election. And I made it slightly closer. I don't know that I can say that I've succeeded in putting effective pressure on him to moderate his positions, that is, to be a little less right-wing, but I'm trying to. That's what I'm up to again this year.
Now,
and, of course, giving people a chance to vote their conscience and their real beliefs by offering them a Green Party candidate in the race.
But so many people get tricked by that. A vote for a Green is like a vote for the Republicans,
Uh-huh.
That's what they say.
Oh, I know. Well, I see the Green Party as a seed that's being planted for the future, and I hope there's going to be a future. I think if we don't plant seeds, plant some real alternatives, it might actually be adequate to deal with the problems we've created for ourselves in this world. There is not going to be a human future.
So in addition to your political actions in Utah, you've also done a lot of personal activism, and you even established an organization that you call the Escalante Wilderness Project.
Right.
Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, before we got here, I think partly because of our experience in the Ward Valley campaign, Tori and I decided to set up a nonprofit of our own to act as an umbrella for projects we were interested in here in southern Utah once we got here, and to as a way to raise money, of course, get your 501c3 status and then see if you can rustle up some funds from foundations that don't try to run your life too much. So we did that after we got here and filed with the IRS and got a tentative or preliminary determination, whatever. And we also heard in the, well, actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. This turned out maybe not to have been the wisest tactic because I think that the established larger environmental groups here in Utah, like the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, saw this as an act of excessive independence on our part and perhaps as a threat to their dominance of the environmental scene here. I mean, SUA basically is the big player in the state, or has been, I think. Yeah, it still is. The Sierra Club kind of just imitates whatever SUA does, provides support. And SUA certainly had been used to calling the shots, and it became quite clear to us by the midsummer of 1999 that they were not thrilled to have us sitting down here in southern Utah, which is part of the name of the group, with our own environmental group. There was also by then a lot of conflict between us and the long-term residents, who call themselves the locals, here in Escalante, on environmental and local issues. And Sue at first was supportive, and then as the more moderate environmentalists in the area distanced themselves from us, because there was so much heat coming down, I think Sue distanced itself as well. I mean, it's somewhat murky exactly what happened. I'm just giving you my opinions based on things I've heard in the years since, and also reactions I remember getting from SUA staff people. It's very much a staff-driven organization, and they're very resistant to having the large membership determine anything, and I would definitely say that they do not want grassroots control, even though that's where they came from 20 years ago. That's not where they're at now. Very much a foundation-driven, staff-driven organization. Does good work.
Right.
Certainly, in terms of resisting encroachments on public lands, resisting ORV damage, and so forth, I think they're doing, you know, very good kind of junkyard dog stuff, suing, putting political pressure on. So I don't want to sound totally negative, but from a kind of structural viewpoint, it can be a problem when an organization kind of fills up an area and gets used to filling it. It may not be very receptive to having other people in its niche as it sees it.
But what kinds of things did you actually do within the context of your organization?
Well, the Escalante Wilderness Project is focused mainly on grazing issues, and Tory mainly has succeeded in raising some money over the years so that we've been able to be involved in at least do a lot of commenting, for what that's worth. And more recently, we're involved in a lawsuit concerning some grazing allotments down in the Kanab BLM district, which stretches over towards Zion National Park in southern Utah. We were also fairly visible in the so-called cattle battle in 2000 and since then, when a couple of permittees refused to pull their cows off of the top of the Kaiparowicz Plateau in the midst of an extremely severe drought. And that has still not really been resolved. The hearing concerning one of the permittees, she appealed the case, has been postponed several times and now is scheduled for the solstice this year, June 21st. So we're going on 4 years now since the collision between the BLM, that is, the BLM people running the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument on the one hand, and the permittees on the other side. And there was quite a lot of uproar over that. Cows were rustled back by the friends of the one of the permittees out of a stockyard where the BLM had taken them after impounding them in central Utah. And the cows were taken across the state line into the Arizona Strip. And BLM, with its usual spinelessness, really did nothing about that. It was, you know, fairly, let us say, extra legal, and BLM kind of ate it in the end.
Patrick, could you?
The political situation in Utah is such that it's very dangerous to challenge the rancher caucus or cowboy caucus.
Patrick, could you explain a little bit more about what you're talking about? You're talking about grazing, people grazing or permitted to graze on public lands?
Right. Yes. Well, as is probably not widely known in the East, public lands are the lands on the national forests, as well as the lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management, which is, we're talking about hundreds of millions of acres of public lands in the West and Alaska. Okay. These lands are divided up into grazing allotments. And that happened largely in the 1930s, back when the Taylor Grazing Act was passed. And each grazing allotment has a certain number of animal unit months, they're called, which is basically a measure of the amount of forage that's supposedly available assigned to it. That determines how many cattle or sheep or goats, actually, I think as well, a rancher can run on the allotment during whatever grazing season the government agency decides is appropriate. So the problem with this system, well, there are a lot of problems. One is that the government charges very little per animal unit month. It charges only a fraction of what the rancher would pay for leasing an area to graze animals on from a private party. Another problem is that the government has been very remiss in reducing stocking levels as the environment deteriorates on grazing allotments or during droughts, for instance. I was just referring to a conflict over during a drought here in Utah. The ranchers, of course, want to be able to keep turning their animals out and not have stock reductions. And the agencies basically are captive agencies like so many others in this regard. They'll make token reductions if things are really bad or pull cattle off months after they should, basically when there's nothing left to eat and cattle are literally dying on the allotments. That's what happened in 2000. Finally, they act, at which point it's really kind of a bit late for the natural systems out there, which sustain permanent or at least long-lasting damage from these acts of cowardice, really, by the agencies that are supposed to be managing our public lands. Okay, so the allotments, as I said, are on both forest and lowlands, that is, the national forests and the BLM lands. And the ranchers buy and trade in permits to graze on these allotments. In fact, they borrow money against them. One of the major obstacles to eliminating this environmentally destructive system out here in the West and elsewhere is that the ranchers basically are dependent on the value of their permits to get credit and to maintain the credit that they have.
Wow.
So that changing the stocking levels on an allotment will affect the value of that allotment, the permit for that allotment, as collateral. Therefore, drastically, at least potentially drastically, impairing the financial standing of the permittee, the rancher that has the permit. Anyway, so it's a very heavily entrenched system. It's been going on for, 70 years now. And some of us have been trying to change it over the years and, making a little tiny bit of headway. I think the public is more aware of the problems with the system than 20 years ago, certainly. But politically, it's a very uphill battle. So our little group, the Escalante Wilderness Project, has, contributed its, widow's mite, you might say, to use New Testament language, to the struggle. We're not very many of us, not much money, but there are not that many groups that are really trying to get the cows and sheep off of public lands. Generally speaking, environmental groups have been very reluctant to take a strong position on this issue. So politically, it's just really, you get tremendous hostility from the powers that be out here in the Intermountain West, for instance, when you go after grazing. Right. Definitely a sacred cow kind of issue.
Well, Patrick, I'd like to move on to a couple of issues regarding the Sierra Club.
Right.
You've been a member of the club for several years, I guess.
And in 4 years now.
4 years. And yep. In 2002, when you were already an officer of a group of the Sierra Club in Utah, specifically the Glen Canyon Group, you took exception to some actions of the club's national board regarding the impending invasion of Iraq by the United States.
Yes.
And Specifically, the National Board of the Sierra Club passed three resolutions that, to some extent, opposed such an impending war. And you and three fellow officers of that Glen Canyon group felt that the club's opposition was insufficient on several grounds. Now, I have before me at least parts of the text of those resolutions, and I'd like to go through them and have you comment on them.
Okay.
The first resolution opposes Iraqi aggression, but it fails to mention U.S. aggression in the form of a proposed preemptive war against Iraq. This is actually from a press release, by the way, that I think was issued by your fellow
the four of us.
Right.
Yeah.
And you said that this resolution supports elimination of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, but fails to mention U.S. weapons of mass destruction. It commends the U.S. for calling for the resumption of U.N. weapons inspection in Iraq, while in reality, other nations compelled the U.S. to accept a resumption of inspections.
Yes.
I think that pretty much says it. Is there anything that you want to add to that?
Well, yeah, I think that the resolution was couched in very evasive terms. And I think that the club management, as I think of them, were trying to sit on the fence, waiting to see which way things would go.
Mm-hmm. I think,
and we felt this was really politically, you know. So we, on the executive committee of the Glen Canyon Group down here in Utah, were very opposed to the invasion and were very upset at the club for refusing to take a strong position against it. In particular, we were upset that the club was disregarding its own many policies against weapons of mass destruction in general, mm-hmm. in favor of nuclear disarmament in general, in opposition to the environmentally destructive effects of war in general. Basically, the board and the executive director, Carl Pope, and other people high up on the staff were ignoring the club's own record of taking positions against mm-hmm. weapons of mass destruction and against war.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was another point.
We called them on it.
Yeah. You mentioned in this press release a third resolution that you said rendered meaningless the 1981 Sierra Club position in favor of peace and in opposition to war as environmentally harmful.
Right.
And you further said that the resolution of the board was, in a sense, a gag order that prohibited Sierra Club members and leaders from taking any public position on the war.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and we went to the media with our dissatisfaction with the club's official stand on the policy, which was actually the only way to effectively alert the general membership to what the club higher-ups were doing or not doing, is perhaps a better way to put it. And once the general membership found out, you know, how weaselly their club leaders were being, there was a firestorm of protest. I mean, there were apparently thousands of emails that came avalanching into the main office in San Francisco, and there were, you know, the club heard from its membership how upset people were with them. And within a short period after the brouhaha in the media, the club joined the Win Without War Coalition. Mm-hmm. Of course, the people who did that would never admit that what happened in November because of our protest action was part of why they decided to join the Win Without War Coalition and come out clearly in opposition to the invasion, but mm-hmm. we think otherwise.
And there was some retaliation against you. There was a move shortly thereafter by fellow officers in the Utah chapter to have you removed from your position.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
this eventually went to the board, the National
yes.
Board of the Club, in May mm-hmm. of 2003.
Yes.
And the board then came out with a very complex proposal for dealing with you and with some of the problems that you had pointed out within the club's structure
yeah.
regarding communication. And so since these really have ramifications beyond just the Iraq war invasion, perhaps we could talk a little bit about how this has turned out. You were subsequently removed from your position as an officer.
Right. I refused to sign an agreement that I would not take things to the media. And my reason for doing that was because there is no clear channels of communication don't really exist in the club. The club management controls the means of communication, basically. And it's very difficult for the members to learn that there are serious disagreements deep inside the club among people who are actually on listservs or know how to get on them and can participate in meaningful debate about basic issues.
Yeah.
It's how people don't know about that. So the issue of transparency and of democracy in the club to us was inextricably linked up with the kind of stand that the club initially took or did not take about the Iraq invasion. Mm-hmm. Very poor communication. They had no idea how strongly a lot of people felt. And they found out once we did an end run around the blocked channels of communication within the club and went to the press. So, you know, one of the things we wanted to see changed was an improvement in internal communications. I haven't seen any sign of that yet.
In fact, one of the provisions of this board action back in May of 2003 is that the board charged a committee of the club called the Communication and Education Governance Committee to actually review these internal channels of communication and to make recommendations for improving how these channels operated. But you've seen no improvement in the year since then.
No. Instead, I think what's happened is that our action and other actions of rebellion from within the club have stimulated a backlash, which took the form of what happened in the current board of directors election.
Right. I want
it's kind of a counter-revolution here, you know, sort of the white Russians.
Right.
Their reaction, I think, is to attempt to, you know, drive out dissenters, you know, stomp out any sparks of new ideas and assert total dominance by the people who have been associated with the club status quo for a long time, which is very disappointing but very typical of large organizations, maybe just human organizations in general. You perceive a threat, so you attempt to destroy it rather than looking at the threat, trying to understand why people are asking for change and considering whether maybe they have a point.
Yeah, at that May 2000 meeting, the board also appointed a task force to...
2003, maybe.
I'm sorry, 2003.
Yeah.
Appointed a task force to investigate problems within the club, implementing the club's policy in favor of draining the Glen Canyon. And in the year since that task force was appointed, have you seen any positive movement there?
Some. There was actually a training academy or whatever the club jargon is for it down in Tucson just, I think, a week or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
And according to people in the Glen Canyon group who went, it was basically 10 steps forward, 9 steps back, to quote one of them. There is more attention being paid to the issue than there has been. The chapters here in the Intermountain West had succeeded in completely obstructing any action on the board resolution to drain Lake Powell that was passed back in the fall of 1996 up until this last year or so. The opposition of the chapters was successful, no question. Now I think people who would like to see the club actually do something about its resolution to restore Glen Canyon and drain Lake Powell have more influence than they did, and that's partly because of our protest action. Even though that was specifically on the issue of the invasion of Iraq and the club's position on, you know, weapons of mass destruction and war and all that, it got in the horse trading that went on afterwards, the Glen Canyon issue came into it. And also, I mean, certainly one reason that we went ahead and went to the media was our accumulated years of frustration around the Glen Canyon issue. I mean, here in Utah specifically, the Glen Canyon group faced a chapter, you know, the state-level organization, that was totally committed to not letting anything happen on the Glen Canyon issue. And they were sitting on us and, you know, pushing us down repeatedly. And that certainly taught us that you can't get anywhere within the club. Communications don't work. the hierarchy is largely controlled by reactionaries as we see them. And therefore, as a result of what we learned from that experience between 2000 and 2002, we saw our only option as going public. So we made that very clear during the period after our protest action. And I think that's one reason why the Glen Canyon issue got brought into the whole negotiation process. Given what's just happened in this election, I'm not feeling a lot of optimism about further movement on the Glen Canyon issue. Unless the lawsuit that Tory and I and other people are involved in succeeds, I think the old guard, the status quo types in the club, will feel that they have won and they can do exactly as they please. And one of the things that they do not please them is activism around the Glen Canyon issue. I mean, I should say that what they see the Glen Canyon issue as a radical notion that was passed in kind of a moment of madness under David Brower's influence in the fall of 96, and that will be very harmful to the club's campaigns on other issues. They've acted similarly on the end commercial logging issue, which the membership voted in some years back. The club has done very little, in my opinion, to implement the will of the members on that issue. Again, because I think the club, the people who pull the strings in the club, feel that it's too radical a position, and it will damage their, you know, other campaigns, as mm-hmm. I'm saying, and their relationship with the Democratic Party also, which is a whole subject that hasn't come up yet.
Sure.
But anyway.
Well, we're just about out of time, Patrick. And we really don't have time to talk about the lawsuit. Perhaps you could come back when this is settled, hopefully within a few weeks. And we can maybe devote an entire show just to the recent board election of the Sierra Club and the outcome of this lawsuit.
Right. We'll see how quickly it gets settled. With legal proceedings, I'm never holding my breath because things tend to drag on.
Right. Okay, well,
so
thank
we'll
you.
See.
Thank you for talking with us today, Patrick.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
This has been another episode of the Vegan Rainbow Show with Bill
and Mike Hudak.
And we'll see you next time at next week at the same time, 6 to 7 Monday nights. Later.